Good morning to the IPv6 working group. I hope you all had a fun social yesterday and are all really fresh to attend this working group. We have a fairly packed agenda, and we have one very, very big topic that we that I would like to spend a lot of time on, so we can actually get a little closer to some conclusions. So, as the agenda looks right now, many of the smaller items should be possible actually to do them rather quickly, so we can actually have the opportunity to spend a lot of time on this discussion. So the first item on the agenda will be a quick update from the RIPE NCC regarding what's happening at the NCC regarding V6 services. Then we have a quick topic to come back on the plenary talk by Gerard Deuring on the IPv6 routing table status. We will probably keep that short, and it's mostly about a chance for people to ask questions to Gerard, whether if they saw something interesting or whatever. Then the main topic will be revisiting the /48 recommendation. There has been a lot of talk in various fora, like errand meetings and also a lot of corridors, etc., about this 48 discussion. Many people have from the beginning had a lot of comments on this recommendation in the first place, and we would like to have like a serious discussion regarding this topic this time. Then we have a topic on renumbering IPv6 networks from Stig Vanas. Reports about actual V6 traffic volume. Since we didn't get any speakers who volunteered already, I'm probably going to skip that one so we can move on quickly to the last part of the agenda. And again, there we haven't heard any comments there, so we are also pretty quickly going to that one. Let's start with the update from the RIPE NCC regarding IPv6 services.
Okay, good morning. I'm Rutte Kooten from the RIPE NCC. Since RIPE 49, we deployed IPv6 on our website and on our FTP servers. This year we're planning to move on with our mail services to make them IPv6 capable.
Microphone is
now
on. Sorry? You have to almost eat it.
Ah, sorry. Okay, we'll start from the beginning. I'm Rutte Kooten from the RIPE NCC. Since RIPE 49, we deployed IPv6 for our website and for our FTP services. Still bad?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Third time, so should be working. Since RIPE 49, we deployed IPv6 for our web services and for our FTP services. And we're planning to do mail this year. So that's it. Very quick, but briefly.
Okay, thank you. Gerard.
One short question on that. What's the plans on integrating the IPv6 WHOIS interface into the main WHOIS server? Because we've been seeing every now and then problems when the WHOIS proxy wasn't able to talk to the database backend for some rate limiting things and whatever. I think it would be useful to have just one WHOIS server that's working or not, and not a two-piece thing that breaks in between.
To be honest, I really don't know. One of my colleagues would be here for the IPv6 update, but he's not here. So, and I have to ask Shane, I have to come back later on that. So if you don't mind, during the break, I will ask and come back on it.
Yeah? Okay, thank you. Next item on the agenda is the global IPv6 routing table status. Gerard Deuring is here to answer questions or give some comments on very interesting stuff that he didn't mention during the plenary.
Oh, well, actually, I'm not going to present anything. The presentation was in the plenary. The presentation is online if you have missed it and want to look into the details. To bring to your attention, in case you haven't been to the routing working group, there's a discussion going on there. What best practice BGP filter towards your peers and upstreams might look like, and that discussion will go on the routing working group mailing list. Well, besides that, V6 routing table is growing, seems to be growing quite smoothly, no big disasters, in the last 8 months or so. So, well, yeah, feel free to ask questions and discuss here, as we had no time in the plenary to do that.
Matthias Lignella, Telesnera, Sweden. Have you made any calculations of the, I don't know how to phrase this, but on V4, we many operators announce a lot of prefixes, but on V6 it's just going to be one or a few, depending on different issues. Have you made any calculations on how many, to being able to make some kind of comparison between V4 and V6? Many people say that I speak to that well, V6 is obviously haven't really taken off yet. It's just like 200 prefixes or whatever it is, or 700. But I mean, you should actually compare that to a relation to, like, I don't know, 1 to 40 or 1 to 100 or whatever that in terms of other V4 prefixes that would be announced if the same company.
I haven't done any comparisons directly on the ratios between how many prefixes will the typical AS announce in V4 world. In V6 world, it's pretty much clean up. We have about something like 400 active ASs in the IPv6 world, and 350 of them announce just one prefix. And from those that announce more than one prefix, most of them have two or three prefixes, and it's due to some sort of renumbering going on from 6-bone to /32, so 35 to 32. So one of the ideas of V6 that you only need to have to announce one prefix seems to work out pretty well so far. There are some big telcos, I think Telia might be one of them, that announces /32 because that's what they got in the start, and then a /20 or 21 because they have gotten a big allocation later. I'm not sure about Telia, but for example, Telstra is doing this right now, and I think that's also a migration thing, but Geoff might be able to answer.
Yeah, we are announcing a /32 as well. That's because of the filters, though, so we just want to make it for.
But I don't see this is a big problem. This is just something that's unavoidable for certain.
But it would be interesting, though, to see what the relation would be. I mean, if the same ASs exist in both worlds and see how much it has shrunk down.
Yeah. Jeff Houston, the answer is 1.419 in V6 and 10.308 in V4.
Thank you very much.
That's the number of announced entries per originating AS.
As of when?
Oh, 15 minutes ago?
Okay. I was asking because the number in V6 is fluctuating quite some, because sometimes you get an AS to leak out 50 prefixes, and that's going to, if you only have 400 ASs, that's going to move the average significantly.
I know. You're only talking about 1.4, and it varies a little bit.
Yes.
Interestingly enough, though, there are actually 10 ASs out there that are V6 only, and the rest are mixed.
Oh, cool.
There are actually 10 that I only ever see in the V6 routing table.
I know at least one of them, that's 1275, and this is because the enterprise holding it, that's a German research network, they just have two ASs, and V4 production AS migrated to another IS when they built their current network, and the V6 experimental part is still using the old AS number. So it's actually the same enterprise having V4 and V6, but yes, one of the ASs shows only up on V6.
I guess that...
Please state your name, because this is a webcast.
Sorry, Pernille Nordunas. I would guess that the /19 that Deutsche Telekom got, they will not announce that as a /19 all over. They would split it up and announce smaller blocks to different ISPs due to political reasons. Because V6 is the same as V4, isn't it? And BGP has always been used for political purposes, and what? Announcing smaller parts to different ISPs, to smaller ISPs and locally and stuff. So I don't think the ideal world would get a /19 from Deutsche Telekom in the V6.
Well, I'm Rüdiger Volk, Deutsche Telekom. If any smaller prefixes are fluctuating, well, this is, at this moment, some piloting stuff, and you shouldn't take care of it. We certainly reserve the right to split things something, but I don't think any politics will intervene there.
I think, why I of course cannot speak for Deutsche Telekom, I think what might be necessary is things like break it up if you have two or more peering lines to some partner to have a locally more specific for traffic engineering, but I certainly don't see the need to have that visible globally.
I'm not going to predict the traffic engineering needs that may be around in 7 years' time.
I'm not so going to do that so either.
Well, okay, some number beyond the next 18 months.
Okay. Any more questions? No more questions? Okay, I saw Shane just walking into the room, so I think he can answer your question.
The question was, what's happening on the RIPE Whois server regarding v6 and the combination of v6 proxy and v4 database backend, because we have been seeing eventually some issues like the IPv6 enabled part not being able to talk to the v4 backend. I'd like to see it integrated.
Okay, we're running a proxy v6 service right now, and the motivation for that was that we currently use IPv4 addresses as client identifiers. And we recognize that wouldn't scale in IPv6. Any single host on the internet can basically produce 2^64 client identifiers if we do that. So the idea was we'd put the proxy up in order to try to look at the query patterns and identify how people actually use the service. And we've had it up for, I guess, about 2 years now. And looking at the patterns, I think we can basically say that the /48 is the new /32. So our plans are to integrate to move the core server itself, to get rid of our proxy, and to move the server to native IPv6. We'll be using /48 as the client identifier to do rate limiting and things like that. Other than the actual bits on the wire, the service is pretty much IPv6 all the way through. We support RPSLNG, which allows you to put your policies and everything like that.
We handle
IPv6 from our servers and everything. So from our Whois server or a web server that does the Whois and everything.
No, I was talking specifically about the bits on the wire.
Okay.
The remaining part is something. Maybe we should do some advertising for, like, people, please put your Route 6 objects in right now.
Okay.
Thank you.
We are going to reshuffle the agenda a little bit to give Thomas some time. So it's now turn for Stig to do the renumbering IPv6 networks talk. And I would appreciate if you could keep it as short as possible.
Yeah, okay. I've just uploaded it, so maybe I could find it here. It was just a few minutes ago.
It's here.
Okay, so I'll talk a bit about IPv6 and renumbering. This is sort of a bigger issue with IPv6 than with IPv4 because addresses are provider dependent or provider assigned. There's some proposals for PI addressing, but, there's nothing yet as far as I know. Also, there is no IPv6 net, so whenever you change the addresses, you got sort of on the internet or outside, you also had to change your addresses on your site. With NAT, you could somehow avoid doing that internally. I and some other people are looking at how to make renumbering easier. What are the issues when I'm trying to renumber and so on. It was said earlier that maybe you could sort of automatically renumber with IPv6 and with router advertisements and neighbor discovery and so on. It was very easy, but it's not. But we can perhaps try to make it simpler. So one part is sort of looking at procedures for how to do renumbering. Another is sort of what issues can show up, which places do you have literal addresses and so on, and are there ways to write applications or configure things so that renumbering will be easier. And for instance, if you look at addressing, some of the things are, if customers have the same prefix from different ISPs, like a /48, whatever it is, then they can more easily renumber or change to another provider because they still have the same prefix length, so they can use the same internal hierarchy of addresses. Another thing is, hopefully, as long as customers stay with the same ISP, they can keep their prefix, not change it too often. Another thing is, there is something called unique local addresses, which might be of help. You could possibly use these unique local addresses internally for internal communications while being connected to the internet with some global addresses. Only problem, though, is at least personally...
I think we have one comment.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you expect that customers of a service provider will always keep their address space. I may remind you that 10 years ago, there were major global network providers that even told their customers, you will be renumbered with your /24 in V4 when you are switched to a different edge box. Mm-hmm. And I think it may be a good idea to actually give exactly the same message translated to V6
okay.
to as the expectation level for the long-term thing that's happening here. Mm-hmm. And of course, we should take care that we don't send out messages that say, well, okay, you people, be aware, it is really hard. If you do slides that say it's not trivial, I certainly agree. I think the slide always should say it is possible, and please be prepared.
Right, okay. Okay, that makes it even more important to look at renumbering, I guess. So, yeah.
So one little comment is also, I forgot to say that I always say, like, please feel free to interrupt our speakers.
Yeah.
I mean, this.
Yeah.
This is a working group session. We want input yeah. from the audience, and that's exactly what we want. So next time, Rudiger, don't hesitate. So much.
Yeah. Well, I was actually hoping to get some comments, and some of this might be slightly controversial, perhaps. So yeah. Another thing is ULAs might be of help. But personally, I'm at least a bit worried that if you both use ULAs and use global addresses on your machines, then we might get some of the application issues with the site local addresses and some of the problems we had earlier again. But, well, it's a possible, well, ULAs might be of help. There might be some other guidelines as well. Whenever you can, you should probably use DNS, like domain names and so on, instead of specifying literal addresses. Also, applications should perhaps not cache DNS lookups too long. Some applications cache DNS lookups forever. Also, some problems with some reseller libraries, like the name service cache daemon on Solaris and Linux caching things a bit too long and not really checking the TTL. For instance, resolvers tend to not really notice if a name server address changes in your resolve conf or something, so you need to restart the application. Yeah.
Yes, Steve, in principle I agree with that, but is there anything which is different from the IPv4 world here? Which I simply don't see, because my feeling is that this is just general DNS issues and it's general... Right. Application design issues, and we should certainly have that as one of the checklist items.
Yeah.
But if there is something which is specific to IPv6, then we should explicitly point to that specific aspect.
Right.
But otherwise, at the moment, I don't see anything in sort of DNS v6 specific.
Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah. I think everything on this slide is almost everything is just the same for IPv4 as IPv6. Yeah. The final thing is, might be possible to use some syntactic tricks like using symbolic names for prefixes and so on, so that in access lists and so on, you might just use a symbolic name for the prefix. So if you learn a new prefix, you just keep using the same symbolic name. That's maybe a bit different for IPv6, but yeah. Okay. So there's been some work done on this already. There is one on renumbering procedures, renumbering without the flag day, which has been around for some while. And some also trying to write some new draft about what to think about when doing renumbering, sort of bring up the different issues and things that should be looked at. There's also been some IPv4 renumbering work before at the IETF, which probably should look a bit more at. Finally, there are some things that might be of help, like a prefix delegation in DHCP v6, and there's some router renumbering protocol, which never has been deployed, I think, or even implemented. But it might be useful if you want to renumber across site boundaries or management boundaries for some small customers or something, perhaps. One thing which makes it easier with IPv6 and IPv4 is that you can typically have multiple addresses, so it's easier to renumber without the flag day. In the sixth project, which I've been working, we have done some tests to look at how different implementations handle having multiple prefixes, how they manage to deprecate a prefix, and so on. And there's been some surprises. It's not always working as expected. So, what I'm sort of wondering about is, have any of you renumbered, and what are your experiences? Is it a difficult problem? Which places have you seen problems, and so on? And expect that at least many of you, and me also, has been through renumbering from six-bound to production prefixes. But I guess it's easier to renumber for a network provider, typically, than it is for an end site. But, well, so if you have some more comments or feedback, please contact me later if you have some thoughts on this.
Any more comments, feedback? No? Then it's time to move on.
Yeah.
We're about 2 more minutes away from having the presentation uploaded.
Okay. I can maybe just ask, do you think this is useful? Is it good that someone is looking at this?
Okay,
good, thanks.
We have a few more agenda topics, so let's just...
Yeah.
Let's see. Francis, do you want to do the 0.6 one really quick?
So 0.6 is a new activity. It's a skill center with the money from the Brittany Regional Council, which is a big thing in France. So,
next.
I don't know. So we have two kinds of activities. The first one is expertise, so we can help anybody which need IPv6 and their product, and who doesn't know how to do it. And the second thing is we have the only labs in Europe which can give you the IPv6 VD logo phase 2, the new one. So it's free too. So we have just come with you. So we are, of course, seeking for anybody which wants to be helped in Brittany, in France, in Europe, everywhere. It's just easier if you are close for face-to-face meetings. So any question? No? Oops.
Okay. We have some, we still have more stuff on the agenda, so don't worry. Let's see. I take that microphone because it doesn't mean I have to chew on it to be heard. Well, I've been asked to give some advertising. This is not my mailing list, and I'm just proxying this. People have felt that there's the need to have a mailing list to discuss IPv6 operational issues. Like, we are seeing this very funny thing in the routing table. Who is originating it? Who's transiting it? Who can do anything about it?
or my router is crashing all the time. Have any of you seen this specific problem and know how to fix it? There's, of course, the six-pawn mailing list, but people feel that the six-pawn mailing list is more for people running experiments and not caring about stability.
So one comment here. I think your slide is slightly misleading in the sense that the six-pawn is going away, but I'm not sure whether the list will go away. In the sense that I've not heard anybody saying it will be going away. It could be, but...
I'm just relaying. Yeah. That's what people feel, that the focus of the six-pawn mailing list is not much...
That's fine, but it says now the six-pawn mailing list is going away.
Okay. The six-pawn is going away, and something might or might not happen to the six-pawn mailing lists. So one of the German V6 geeks, Daniel Rosen, who has been relaying messages from Jabber all the time in the plenary, has created a new mailing list. The address is given there. The focus is really operational content, and it seems to be working. The traffic volume is quite low, but the few things that have been there have been well focused and good content. Right now there are about 350 people on the mailing list. Among them, 17 vendors, 11 large research networks, something like that. People not always introduce themselves, but Daniel had a look at the mail addresses that he saw in the list. So I think most of the important big ones are there, and feel invited to subscribe. The subscription is done via a web mailman interface, and it's pretty straightforward. There's a list archive as well. Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Wilfried?
Which organization is running the six-pawn list?
The organization for Marina Del Rey.
Okay.
You might know those people.
Sorry, I might, Wilfried Weber, only Vienna University. I'm probably sounding like a bookkeeper and a bean counter. But if this list actually takes off, and it seems to, then we should at least investigate the possibilities to have a copy of the archive in some, I shouldn't say safe place, to imply that this place is not safe. But more in the sense of a place which may have more historic stability than something which is run by an activist and might have to do something else in the future. I don't know this guy personally, and I don't want to imply that he's not going to do a professional job. It's just from a long-term internet history point of view.
I think you have a point here. As this is a private site, of course, and whatever might happen to this person, like having a job in Australia and disappearing from the face of Earth, There's the RIPE IPv6 mailing list, but people have felt that this is too much RIPE-centric, so RIPE might not be a body to host it. So, maybe take it to the list and discuss it there, where to put the archives for long-term stability. I don't know.
Okay, it's Thomas' turn.
I just operate the overhead.
And let's see.
Time you want.
You get all the time.
Wow.
No, preferably something like 10-15 minutes, and then we can spend the rest of the time on discussion, and then we have one remaining topic left. So.
Okay, so we do have a fair amount of time. Yeah. So what I'm going to do here is just sort of go over some points. A lot of this comes right out of RC 3177 with a little bit of editorializing on my part and sort of my perspective. And I'm not even really making a recommendation per se here or a starting point so much as I think that there are some issues here that we ought to think through and, you know, mull over the next few weeks as we, you know, come to an agreement on what the right thing to do is here. So, so looking back, what are some of the original considerations? So if you go back, you know, 3177 sort of says a /48 is a good, reasonable default in most cases. And I think it's actually interesting to go back and actually try to recall what the motivations were, because I think some of them aren't captured in the document itself maybe as clearly as they could have been in retrospect. Okay, and when I look, when I sort of think back and at what people's motivations were, I think one of the strongest was that if you look at what's happening in the IPv4 world, the default practice, whether it's operational or business or whatever, the default practice seems to be that you have to justify address usage, and it's not an assumption that if you think you need public address space, that you should get it. Okay, and this comes from a more of a focus on conservation and getting good utilization and so forth. And one of the big things that we wanted to do with IPv6 is to remove that perception, remove that perceived barrier, so that in fact people would get addresses and it wouldn't be a big deal, and you would get what you needed and what you could use. Okay, and but in particular, it's a significant departure from what the operational practices were, and that is, I think, the reality is, at least for home users, for example, is if you want to get multiple public addresses, it's generally not easy to do so. It's often possible to do so, but it's not sort of the default and the easy thing. And one of the assumptions we're making now is that in today's world, you know, a single address for a single host really isn't that interesting, because you know, you tend to build networks, you tend to have lots of devices, or certainly more than one. Okay, so in sort of like an anecdote on sort of my personal experience with trying to get IPv4 public address space from my ISP at home was, they allowed it, they even had a website, you know, that said what you had to do, but when I tried to invoke it, I quickly discovered that nobody else apparently had ever done so before, because it didn't really work, and, you know, when you called the help desk, it was clearly an exception path that had not been executed before. Okay, so it wasn't that they didn't do it or weren't willing to do it, but the fact is that they, since it was an exception, we all know that exceptions have a high cost associated with it and are not the easiest thing to do. Okay, so what are some of the desirable traits that we want to have? I think one of the things that's really important is that it's simple and it's easy to understand. It's a policy that's easy to understand for all. What I mean by that is if an insight, you know, wants to get address space, it's pretty easy for it to figure out what it should ask for and what kind of justification it needs to make. And get what a reasonable amount is for the type of user or the type of insight that it's going to be. And I think it works both ways, for both the user and for the LIR ISP, in that one of the things I think you want to avoid is having you know, the amount of address space, for example, that you get from an ISP become a differentiator in the market. So they start competing, for example, by saying, well, we'll give you more addresses if you come to us. Because that's not really, you know, helpful in terms of global stewardship. On the other hand, you don't want them all to be in the same boat where they say, like, well, you don't get addresses unless you really have to jump through hoops, and everybody does the same thing, and so we're also doing the normal thing, and that's fine. So I think it's, you know, clearly useful to have a number of sort of categories or buckets of users that you try to fall into, and in the 3177 framework, we had the /128, we had the /48, and the /64, sort of the three buckets. And you can certainly imagine that more choices gets you better utilization. You're able to sort of find the right size allocation for each sort of particular circumstance, and you might, in the long run, get better overall utilization and keep the consumption down. But you have to balance that with, you know, make it understandable and make it simple, because if you end up having too much choice, what ends up happening is people just say, like, well, I'm just going to go with this one because it's the simplest. And even, you know, the ISPs, LIRs will fall into the same situation, because it's not, they don't want to spend a lot of time, you know, having discussions about which bucket someone needs to fall into, or run into situations where, you know, one set of ISPs does it one way, another set does it another way, and then they end up looking like they're differentiating on those kinds of considerations. And I mean, in some sense, that's, I think, happening even today with IPv6, where, you know, there's clearly an assumption among a lot of people that a /48 is what you get, even though if you look at what 3177 says, it's not quite that clear cut. And there are certainly circumstances where a /64 is fine. Okay. Another pretty important thing is, I think we want operational protocols and practices that support flexibility in what the actual M-site allocation is. And again, this is really sort of the don't do it the way we did it in V4, where the default really is one address. And so what you end up having is the practices and the protocols that are actually used don't really support alternate models easily. And so it becomes actually hard to deploy them, even if the ISP wanted to do so. I mean, you have to make it easy for them, especially when everything is a commodity market in some sense. So again, desirable to greatly reduce the amount of justification from end sites to get a reasonable amount of space. Another consideration that the 3177 talks about is select boundaries that simplify DNS reverse tree management. Okay, and I think that for a lot of people that means like nibble boundaries, for example. But one thing that I think we have to realize as well, back when 3177 was done, we had the A6 resource record format, where there was a feeling that we would use that to simplify renumbering, but since then we've essentially deprecated that, it's become experimental, and there certainly is no, you know, uptake by the industry to go in that direction. Okay. So one related question that I'll just throw up here, and this is, I don't want to really start a discussion here, and this is something that, a topic that has dogged the IPv6 working group as well, but I'll raise it here simply because it came up specifically at the ARIN meeting last week during discussions about, about what a site is with the /48 bounty. That is, if you have a, you know, if you're an LIR and you have customers that want to obtain IPv6 space, how do they describe themselves? Are they always one large site? Or are they actually multiple sites? And the specific example you can think of is certainly as like a large enterprise, you know, with Fortune 500 companies, are they considered a single site? Or, in fact, if they're geographically dispersed, is each one of those individual sites considered a quote-unquote site that's eligible for /48? And the same thing goes for like a smaller company where you might have a lot of small branch offices that are very small. Is each of those a /48? Or should each of those, should the entire organization be covered by /48? And if you look at the policy, there's not really a lot of guidance in that regard.
Do you want to get remarks to that one, right?
Sure.
I was thinking about that issue about 2 weeks ago in a different context, and my bottom line after doing that exercise was that this is a completely non-technical issue. The only reasonable thing I could come up with is to separate those things according to the lines of who is doing the address plan and who is having the operational management responsibility. And if you end up with a big cloud of diverse physical sites, which are operated under the umbrella of one concise sort of group management approach, then from my point of view, this is a site, because this entity is responsible for the addressing plan, and you can easily sort of do the proper things. If you have an organizational structure where the individual physical sites have their own autonomy to do things, then those are a site. And that's sort of the only thing I could come up with over the last 2 weeks.
I've been thinking about that, that issue as well, and come to a slightly different conclusion. I tend to actually tie it to technical things. Like if these three branch offices are connected to my network in three points that are different aggregation areas, I tend to see that as three different /48s, because then each site, well, each branch office gets a 48 from that respective aggregation area. But I agree that this is not very well defined at all.
Right, and I think where that comes into play sort of from our perspective is if there's confusion in the sort of the LIR ISP insight space on what they're allowed to do here, it's not helpful to the community. Even if we don't really have a sort of a simple, precise answer, one size fits all, at least having some place where there's discussion about some, you know, things to consider and which ways to go, which what's considered sort of acceptable by the community would probably be useful.
Jeff Houston, APNIC. This is a continuum. And at one side, we know what a site probably isn't. My mobile phone probably isn't a site. On the other side, you know what probably is a site, or probably more than one, which is the transnationals. So all we're discussing here is a continuum. And one of the temptations is to draw a very hard line in the sand. It's probably wrong, because you're drawing a line in a grey spectrum. What you're really trying to say is, inside a process which we're trying to make simple, can we define either end? Hopefully making the middle one where the customer and the LIR are having a discussion, but you're trying to minimize that area where you're having the discussion. Yep. So rather than trying to tightly define what a site, you know, is or isn't at that boundary point, it's probably easier to define either extreme. And I do recall in previous iterations of this discussion, one of the fundamental questions that was always asked is, what is my phone? And that's a really good question, because if a phone becomes a site, you really are pushing it way too far one way.
Yeah, and what I was going to say, I have another, the next slide is going to talk about, the recommendation 3177 talks about a /64 for like a phone. And thinking about that, you know, I have actually a hard time convincing myself that that's actually always right. Because in some sense, it depends, you know, for example, you can imagine a world where you have a phone, but when you go home, you plug it into a cradle, and now all of a sudden it fronts your entire house. And, you know, the examples that were specifically listed there were Bluetooth, and I say, well, okay, Bluetooth is a pretty small network, or, you know, Wi-Fi, they didn't call it that. And, you know, the world has changed already a lot in that. And you can imagine a cell phone really fronting an entire site. as a backup, if nothing else.
But my point in this comment is, rather than trying to divide the world into black and white, I think you've got to recognize that all you can do is offer clues as to black and white and allow the uncertainty to be negotiated.
Agreed.
So I'm taking my chairperson hat off for a few seconds. As an example for France, there's people now using, for example, 3G phones, for example, to hook up a train to the internet and stuff like that. And in that kind of moments, you really get into this really gray area. And I think one of the problems, indeed, in this document is that there's too much mention of the technology instead of describing what the case that is being handled. And the technology really doesn't matter. It's like there's certain technology that you use up to hook up a lot of people or just one household and stuff like that.
Yep.
Move on.
Okay. So I think this is the last slide. So what I'll just sort of do is go back and review what 31 and 77 actually says. It does say /48 for home networks, sort of always on type networks, /48 for enterprises, both large and small. Though it does say that a /47 or more for very large subscribers without really defining what that is. /64 for mobile phones, and the example I give is, Bluetooth 802.11b. And then a /128 for a dial-up PC, where the emphasis is on single node and not multiple nodes behind that. Okay, and that's it. So questions, comments, discussion?
The floor is open. Jeff.
This is a topic with a fair deal of history. And the history that we've been waffling around a fair deal in is actually /56 and /48. Mm-hmm. For quite some time in the development of this, the expectation and indeed the default assumption we said was, when we've got subnets, /56 should work. And on the whole, that had a fair deal of credence and push. However, when some of the larger corporates who actually do front into the IETF came and looked at this, said, nah, we'll never fit in. And I suspect that 1 or 2% of the market dragged the number up, because there was this real desire to make things so brain dead simple that everything was the same. And I kind of wonder if the search for brain dead simplicity is ignoring the fact that inside most ISPs are some brains and are some operating expertise, and you can, as we've proved with V4, actually do remarkably complex addressing plans. I'm not advocating complexity, although it's part of many large telcos' business plans. What I am advocating, though, is that raising the bar to the extreme edge for everyone was just extravagant. And I'm not sure that that was really a sane thing to do. So, to my mind, that 56-48 conversation had a fair deal of substance in it, but I think we got tugged by a small number of folk from larger enterprises, as distinct from holding our ground, saying, you can always get more, but the default for the millions, the billions, is actually 16 bits, which is, really a 90%, 95%, even possibly 99.9% hit point.
Yeah, I tend to agree.
So one of the things that I, and this chairperson had off, one of the things that I didn't see you mention that much is actually those technical considerations why people choose this boundary in the 48. And one of the things that I would like to see some discussion on, or that I would be interested in, is one of those considerations basically renumbering. So if you switch provider, that you can count on this other provider to basically give you the same amount of address space. And one of the nice things of having a fixed boundary at the low end as an end user means you can just count on getting the same thing if you switch from your DSL provider to your cable provider, for example. And I just would be interested in some comments in that area.
Can I actually respond? I thought I had a point there, but I don't, but I apparently didn't. So I agree. My take of looking back on what the actual requirement was or what the problem was that was supposed to solve is clearly renumbering from a subnet of size X to a subnet of size X minus something is very painful. And it is that kind of renumbering that we wanted to avoid, where if you switch an ISP, you now have to renumber your internal network because you've got fewer bits to play with for subnet space. But as long as you're always renumbering to the same size or larger, I think the argument about, keeping the boundary fixed is met in some sense, because it's you don't have to redo your internal plan. It's just the upper bits that you shift.
Gabriella Paolini from GAR. I can speak about a practical example because we are doing an addressing plan for a school, to connect school in our country. And so it's very difficult to adopt this recommendation because we have 40,000 of schools to connect, and there are different sites because there are site and site. And so it's very difficult to understand why use a /48 for a primary school that can grow, but no for this number. And so it's very difficult. We have to think of something of different.
Well, so let me to clarify, when you say that, like growing, is the concern that even if some sites are /48 and they need to grow, that they can't, or that it's hard?
They can. They are primary school with a child. That I think that it's a bit impossible that they can grow for a /48. But maybe that a /64 is not enough for this kind of school. So there are so big difference from /64 and /48. I think we can have something inside this.
I think that's pretty clear that /64, /56, /48, those are very different boundaries, and what you can do within that context is very different. And, one size fits all, has the advantage in one sense of, you don't have to think about how you number your network, because you can be as inefficient and kind of silly as you want, and that's simplicity at one level, but it's not clear that you need 48 to have that kind of simplicity. You get it with 56 in a large number of cases.
Despite the fact that Jeff is not in line, I saw him jumping up and down, and I think he's basically his turn right now.
I just wanted to make the point that this is a competitive supply of the good. And quite frankly, out there you will find folk offering different things.
Yep.
The idea in V6 was that all the providers could possibly service your needs was kind of daft. If you are a large enterprise that's really occupied at /48 and you're thinking of going to another provider, your requirement says, well, I need the same /48. Yep. And it was kind of daft to think that we had to write that into the standard. Was in actual fact, it's part of a marketing reality.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I said, raising the bar all the way up so that everyone's trying to be uniform is a denial of the market that we see. It's a denial of the way most consumers would operate, particularly if they are larger than the default. Because normally the idea that you are larger than a default says you have enough wherewithal, support and capability to have justified that. Quite frankly, 16 bits of subnet is not done in a backyard by someone who knows only consumer electronics and the on-off button. You know, that's the whole sort of silly thing behind the /48. That was why I was jumping up and down.
Carlos Friases from the Portuguese Ayn Rand. Like Gabriela, I have almost the same problem. I'm planning for the Portuguese schools from the first grade to the 12th grade. And, it's almost the same problem because most of our 9,000 schools are almost unmanaged networks. So that was almost Jeff's point. So for us, it really does not make sense to hand out 65,000 subnetworks to almost an unmanaged environment. So.
So what do you have a thoughts on what a more reasonable number would be? I mean, would 56 be a reasonable, sort of in the middle, or is even that too much?
That was our first thought, but we are still uncertain for going for RFC 3177 or do it differently.
Matthias Ignella, Tele Sonera. I think 56 would be a quite an appealing number. Not really done the homework going through the whole thing of the exact number, but I think at least we should discuss something else rather than just 48 and 64. And also, if you keep it rather simple, that residential users get a 56 and the corporations and organizations get a 48 if they want. It's quite easy if you move from one operator to another, you just get another 56 and yeah. Story. And if someone would have already got a slash 48 somewhere else and want to move to Telia, well, of course we want the business, so we like to make money, so we'll give them a slash 48 and end of story. So anyhow, I think a slash 56 would be pretty good. And also comment on the mobile phones, I do not foresee really that you would need a slash 48 on a mobile phone, or that they will actually be your exit point for your home network, just for the simple fact that wires will always be faster than wireless. So people tend to actually get, even though wireless technology improves, but at the end of the day, fixed cables will always be better. So nothing is going to change that from my point of view, at least. And so you will probably end up with both.
Okay. Right, I mean, yeah. Oh yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, in terms of like what the right size for mobile phone is, that, you know, I think it's a sort of example where having it be larger than the default for a home user doesn't make sense. Making it the same size or less, you know, would seem to be reasonable.
It does make sense to have a mobile phone as a router, but one subnet with 64 bits will be quite sufficient, I would say.
Well, I mean,
it's quite a few hosts there.
I mean, that's an interesting question, because in some sense I agree that, you know, you would probably use a wired line most of the time, but as a backup, wouldn't it be nice if you could plug in the cell phone and have it work? But have it work in some sense means that whatever network you have, it just sort of numbers automatically. You don't have to jump through any hoops to sort of deal with the nodes that are behind another router internally that wouldn't be reachable if it was only on a slash 64. So part of this is just sort of making the technology work, even if it may not be the greatest idea. And not the best performance, but there are scenarios where having it just work is just really convenient.
Francis Dupont, I believe the important case is home networking. First, because it's a potential number of networks is very large, mm-hmm. far larger than others. The second is home networks will be not managed. I believe it will be some kind of auto-configuration. We are working at Francis about it, so if you use some kind of hierarchy, I believe you have a good HD ratio, .8, something like that. If you use a random allocation of SLA, you get clearly a .5 for HDR ratio for avoiding too much collisions. The problem is we don't know today how many links we get inside on a network. Perhaps it will be 10, 20. So you have, I believe 48 is fast. It's perhaps a lot, but slash 60 should be not enough. The problem is we don't know what would be the future, as usual.
Right. Yeah, I think it's an interesting observation that you could imagine at the home network or in small networks, you would have auto configurations or auto numbering of networks. And then the question is what's a reasonable number of bits that makes that, finds a good balance between simplicity and, you know, sort of stupidity in the algorithms versus, you know, something that takes a fair amount of sophistication and complexity, and we'd be better off not going there.
I don't think there is a mini renumbering problem.
What was the question?
I believe you'll use something like prefix delegation, and you have one part given by the ISP. You can't change it. ISP can change, but not you. And your playground is the SLA, the bits between the ISP prefix and the slash 64 for links.
Okay, Wilfried. After Hans-Peter, I'm going to close the mic, and at that point I think it's time to ask a few questions and see what people feel about the general direction that we should take.
Yeah, I'd like to come back to the question what the sort of reasonable number of bits should be to play with your subnet structure. Be it at 16, then we end up with 48.
Yeah.
Be it at 8, then we end up with 56. or be that something in between? And just a couple of observations, in particular because I was thinking through the regional school network issue a couple of weeks ago. And while I agree that at first glance it seems to be outrageous to give 16 bits of subnet space to a small school, taking it the other way down, like giving them 8 bits to play in, might probably be a bit too restricted, because right now we don't see a technology or an application which sort of suggests that each pupil is a subnet. But on one side, we are sort of talking about projection times of, what was it yesterday, 60 years or something like that? Yeah, or longer. And I think that does not exactly fit with that type of discussion, like, can we today imagine a primary school to use more than 256 subnets? That's sort of one of the things that I had in my head. Yeah. The other comment I'd wanted to make is that in a different context, like we are just right now ramping up a field test with ADSL, IPv6 native for our students. And again, in most of these situations, probably giving them 8 bits to play in is sufficient, is more than sufficient. But what are actually the options to take between 56 and 48? I think reasonably we could just, in the first round of iteration, we would probably look at 56. That's probably okay for a large number of home user SOHO type thingies, but I think it's not going to be enough for a very large number of commercial customers. And in a different and project environment, I have already heard people toying with the thought, like, how are we going to preserve the business model of selling the shortage of IPv4 addresses under disguise as a commercial product? Because right now they are having the package to offer one dynamic address or four IPv4 static addresses, or sort of being a real network. And they are actively thinking or wondering, how are we going to transport that type of business model and selling model into the V6 world? So coming from that end, I think going to 56 is, for a large population, far too small. And then we are back in this situation that you are going to have to bargain if you want to do ISP hopping. But I don't think the bargaining is going to happen between 48 and 47. But there is the danger that the bargaining starts with 56. And then I think we are seeing a large number of potential customers being hit by that. So we might want to look at splitting it not on the byte boundaries, but on the nibble boundaries. Sort of, and then it starts to become not so simple any longer. And I want us to think about these implications before we come up with a recommendation.
I'm Leo Roberts from Stanford University, and Aaron, and I guess I'm not eating the mic enough here. Sorry. I guess I've always thought the /48 one size fits all was a little extreme, especially looking at trying to deploy out to, say, 3,000 DSL users that are connected to Stanford. The size that I would need, if they all expected a /48, just kind of seemed over the top. So I definitely support the /56, looking at that. And I would think not having too many choices is probably better, and making the criteria fairly easy to move up if you need it.
Yeah, I think that's actually something to keep in mind is you know, we're not locking insights into a particular allocation size. Presumably getting more, you know, as they grow ought to be fairly straightforward. And so, you know, I think the business case is the interesting one, because if you gave all businesses, for example, /48, that's probably a fairly large number of /48s you're giving out. But if you have some sort of threshold that says, if you are fewer than 10 employees, or, you know, less than $1 million in revenue, or just, you know, some sort of something you can measure easily that distinguishes between, you know, pretty small and the rest, you might also get a pretty good, that might be something where you get a pretty good savings by not making the default be a /48 across the board.
Ulrich Kirmer, Vienna University. What I miss in this discussion is a little bit what problem space we are trying to address with this discussion, being it either that we are afraid of giving someone too many addresses he might probably not need by giving him a /48? Or are we afraid of running out of addresses too fast if we give everyone that much address space he doesn't need? Because if it's the first problem, I've considered this discussion a bit awkward, but...
I think it's the latter.
It is honestly the latter. That what we've found right now is that if you, again, go through the population sums and look at the longevity of the entire address plant, we start to get uncomfortable about its viability in around 5 to 6 decades out. And as engineers, if you're trying to build something for a period where you really don't know, and it may well be a century, and you're giving away /48s at the front, you're going to have to come back and be a lot more brutal later on. Trying to be just a little bit more conservative at the start might get us the required bit. So the motivation is the second. It would be really nice to get back around 6 bits of this space. 6 bits equals what? Yep. How much? What's the multiplication factor for 6 bits? Times 64.
64, yeah.
Right? 60 years versus a longer time. And those 6 bits might well be quite critical. So that's the motivation.
Hans-Peter Hohlen from Visma. I was just thinking that we need to be very careful about adding technologies to the addressing policy here, because the argument that people will use cables rather than wireless may hold in Sweden, but definitely won't hold in Norway. And then look at the rest of the world. I mean, there are huge parts of the world which don't have cables to the home, which will be wireless or on mobile networks. In Norway, they already sell UMTS as wireless broadband priced at the same level, fixed price. So, I mean, that push is already there.
Carlos, yeah. I actually closed the mic after Hans-Peter. You will actually have a chance after this one. So I think it's actually time to ask a few questions to the audience to get a little bit idea in which direction we go. I want to emphasize these are not going to be questions that lock us into anything. It's just to get a general feeling where we are going. And this will be revisited because this is purely for discussion purposes. So you're not going to be locked into anything. This is to get a little bit of a feeling of the room. I will formulate a few questions. After those questions, you will be free also to come up and say there's maybe some other questions that had to be asked if I was wrong. So, one of the questions that I have, how many people feel that this document actually should be reopened and changes have to be made, and irregardless of what the changes are? That's, for the minutes, a lot. Are there people who think this document is fine as it is? Okay. Do people feel that we have to change the 48 to a different number, or do people feel more like we have to add a different category? So you could think about a category as a SOHO network, and that could, for example, be a 56, but it doesn't have to be a 56. So instead of, because currently we have two categories, 48, 64, we could add a third category, or do we want to go for simplicity? I have the feeling I'm not clear.
Yeah.
Okay. Wilfried has the chance to ask a clarifying question.
Yeah, well, this on?
No.
I would be very, very happy with keeping the 48 as the default for whatever type of organizations, coming up with a couple of entries in that, and adding another category, and sort of making it a voluntary decision for the applicant to categorize themselves, or to have the upstream distributing the addresses sort of doing the suggestions. But maybe we should also, at the same time, add something which allows those holders of the smaller blocks to upgrade without being dragged into the whole machinery of talking to a regional registry and whatever it takes. So in that sense, I vote yes, we should add another category, but there has something to go with that.
What is the question? Do you
Okay, so first of all, this is a general direction. So there's a lot of wiggle room in which direction we.
It's on. The microphone doesn't work.
I just had to shout.
Okay. So the question is we could, because we have this document, we could, for example, just simply lower the 48 requirement to something lower. That would be one option. Another option would be to add a category for things like SOHO networks that would be lower. And for example, that could be a 56, but we could decide on something else. Would people prefer to add a category, so something else, or would people prefer to just lower the limit?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. So do people like to add a category? That's a lot, again. Are there people who would prefer instead to simply lower this 48 boundary to something else? A lot less. Okay. Then another question that I saw coming up is this document is, according to quite some people, unclear in really categorizing who is what. There's technology issues like phones are used as an example, but should we really use different names that don't describe the technology? Do people feel that the current document as it is unclear and there's a lot of clarification needed, or should we focus the discussion more on like just getting a new boundary in and that's it? Yeah?
If you're aiming for a yes or no question, please don't ask her or a question.
Right. I mean, one thing I think is also worth noting, I mean, this RFC was originally a recommendation from the IETF community, and that, you know, needs to get translated into actual policies that are adopted by the individual registries. So what I think the ultimate end point we want to be at is that the policies make it very clear and relatively unambiguous for both the LIRs and the MSITEs, so that they have a pretty good idea of what they want to do in most of the cases.
Here's this, Jeff Houston, here's this interesting interplay between standards and policy. By adding another category, you're almost going into the standards area because you're saying to vendors of equipment, when you want keyless autoconfig, so I don't have to SNMP in there, I build it a /56. It's almost a standards action. So that first decision we took would actually is going to require some going off to the IETF and actually saying there's a standard here, vendors look out. The next question you're kind of asking is, what are the criteria that bracket things? Is a policy/business implication. Now when I'm looking at making device X for a home, how many millions would fit into the /56 category? How big's my production line? It's quite premature in some ways to ask for categorization, but it's interesting to note that the policies are really this venue, not the IETF. Yeah. So if you're really asking, should we talk about this, it's almost a tautology. This is why we're here. But, you know, you can ask the question if you want.
So the question is basically for how many people actually think that this document as it currently is actually unclear in the first place? Okay. So a lot of people apparently seem to understand this document. Or they don't vote. I don't have any other questions listed down. So part of the thing that is probably going to happen is that some people are going to write an internet draft about this very topic. I think the input that we got will give those authors, and I think Thomas could potentially be such an author, some idea in which direction to go. I think it's very important to realize it's a discussion document. So even if Thomas decides to take a particular direction, that doesn't mean we are locked into that. It's very much changeable in many ways, but it gives a little bit of idea of, you know, what comes out of the community, what does the community think about it. As Jeff says, we are also here at a very fine line between policy and standards. Although this might be in an internet draft initially, there's parts that actually
might end up at a registries plate and will be taken out of an internet draft. I think an internet draft will be useful simply because we have to start somewhere, we have to document it somewhere. But there is a very fine line here between, and I think actually if whoever you ask, nobody will even give you exactly the same answer where that line is. So we'll just have to figure that out and just come with some, probably some kind, I hate the word compromise because it's not, but we will just have to find a way to basically deal with this. Are there other questions that people would like to bring up in this context? Because I ask a few questions, you know, I'm the chair, I can ask those questions, but I don't want to stop you to ask a similar question to the audience so those potential authors can have a little bit of idea where we should be going. We had Carlos actually behind the mic when I closed it, and we have Bernard. So Carlos has a chance, if this is relevant to this discussion, and next one is Bernard.
Well, the point I was having about handing out 56 to an almost unmanaged network is that if at some point in time they come to the LIR and ask for a slash 48, I would give that without any questions asked. So it's simple. And a second point about the commercial issue that ISPs are now charging for fixed IPv4 addresses. Well, I would say also charge for fixed IPv6 subnets. It's the same business model.
Okay, Bernard.
I didn't listen what he's saying, but okay. My question is, why do we need to have fixed boundaries? We tried to discuss about this a couple of years ago. Why not simply to decide to allocate a certain size prefix from what the users or the subscriber needs? If we are a large company, you will get a slash 48 or even shorter prefix. If you are a smaller company, you will get a slash 46, 56, I don't know what. Why do we need a fixed boundary?
So I think I give Jeff a chance to answer that question. And Bernard, you also want to ask this question to the audience as a whole? Okay.
In a world of billions of devices and millions of networks, we can expect a large proportion of those networks to actually be consumer electronics, manufactured so that you turn it on and do basically keyless startup. Now, one would expect that you might be able to reach in and change things if you know what you're doing, but like a video cassette recorder, there's more behind the buttons. The buttons just do a default thing. In a very, very big world of networking, a lot of networking is commoditized and wrapped. What we're trying to do is to say, what bits we shrink wrap, you turn it on and it does a reasonable thing, is worth shrink wrapping. So I'm not talking about corporates and enterprises and folk with staff buying dedicated gear. I'm down there in the luggage tag world, in the provider for the luggage tags going, what sort of, you know, massive deployment do I use for small, cheap devices that just plug in and work? And one has a suspicion that they're going to try and do the subnetting thing by default. So what advice would you offer a vendor? What sort of is the default industry deployment? At the moment, the slash 48 is kind of, well, you know, it'll fit anything, and it's probably true. The slash 56 or something lower goes, you can manufacture this in the millions and not use up too much address space in your plans as a result. And by default, it'll work and do the right thing. So I'm saying, think consumer electronics. That's why you'd actually like some setting points.
Maybe to be more clear, I'm not against a default size. That's okay. But then why to fix different categories? As soon as I have a default, the point is already done, I guess. And the other thing, maybe...
I think, Bernard, we are talking here about minimum default categories.
No. My point is, why categories? I agree with Jeff on the default. For the industry, it is quite important to have a default. But why to set a category then?
But but how can you have a default without a category? That's
we have five or six categories. Mm-hmm. My point is set just a default, and that's it. And then you decide as a local internet registry which prefix you want to allocate to which company.
So, do I understand that you mean you want to set us, like say, three categories, could be different number, and the only thing in the document that we could potentially mention is examples, but it is you as a user or whatever who decides in which category you actually fall?
No.
No?
My point is, I would like just one category, which is a default one.
And everything else justified beyond that.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, so okay. I think I view it a little bit differently because my fear is that, well, two things. One of the reasons why, one of the advantages of having at least a small number of standard categories is it makes it easy for the LIR to count users and basically justifies utilization when it needs more address space and so forth. If you get into having arbitrary prefix boundaries and the customer has to justify what they do and you get all this mix of stuff that's actually deployed, there's extra overhead in counting that both at the LIR level and at the RIR level and so forth. And I think, if you take it to the extreme, you'll find that in practice, you won't get that fine granularity because people will just use a couple of default categories to keep it all simple. And a good example is if a business comes back and says, well, I need a little bit more space, do they want one more bit of space? No, they probably want four more bits of space or something because they don't want to have to come back again in 6 months to do the same thing over again. And that leads again to sort of default, in some sense, default categories without even trying.
Okay. Next comment.
I had another comment, but I forgot what it was.
I also have two comments. I hope I remember the second one. But anyhow, having the floating kind of breakpoint here, I don't really like that either. It's when you maintain an address plan, you will end up in a situation, I think, where the actual reason to have a floating breakpoint there is that to be more efficiently use the address space, but you will at the end of the day end up when you do the actual planning and how many of these sizes of network do you fit here in this actual router to work with aggregation, all sort of other things, and you have if you have 10 different levels of networks or what have you, you will end up with some not used spaces and so on. So I don't think that would be actually at the end of the day not be sufficient and actually do the whole purpose. Another thing I would like to bring up here might be a bit controversial though, but at least I think we should not skip the alternative of actually looking into changing the 64 bits for the hosts. Is a tremendous, it's an unbelievable, tremendous waste of address space. And every time I explain how addressing works for IPv6 for people that are new into this, they get kind of shocked. And if you also look at it in practice, what operators to a large extent will do, or at least what we will do, is use the HPv6 to allocate the address to the host anyhow, so it won't be automatically generated from the MAC address. And in the 3G world or UMTS world, there is no MAC address whatsoever. So, but I realize this is gonna make some tensions here. But I think it's at least something that we should consider, but maybe not in this first discussion because maybe it's two separate things. Because otherwise, we will never get at home with the first one.
Yeah. I just want to have one clarifying question, and that is when you said you are happy to use DHCP, for example, to number, is that the number of your customers or the number of your infrastructure? Okay.
Okay. I'm going to close the mic after.
Application as well. In the infrastructure, we anyhow do all the configuration manually because you need to know or like to know what the actual address is at the other end, rather than having something weird just generated that you cannot possibly keep in mind. And also, if you need to change the network interfaces or what have you, you don't want it to change because then you have to go back to DNS to change it there as well, and people forget, and you have just a mess. So I think
the time has, it was a great idea in the first place, but it has, a lot of time has elapsed since then. It's not really any useful anymore, I would say, and not, won't be really used in practice.
Okay, it's Gerrit Stern, and the microphone is closed now.
And, well, actually, I could just sit down, because I fully agree with Matthias, actually. 64 is a huge waste of address space, but I don't think we are going to see that changed, because that's so cast in stone in the IETF. On the specific topic on floating boundaries or not, I don't think floating boundaries are a good idea, because that I have a different customer clientele than Bernard has. In a research network, you can, well, make plans that cover the entities, and the entities are happy to get addresses and connectivity. In an ISP environment, you have too much competition between ISPs, and then you get address space haggling again. Like, with you, I can only get a 52, but if I go to UUNET, I get a /50, and so I'm not going to sign the contract with you. We had that in the V4 world. It was not fun, or it isn't fun. And this is what I really like about the V6 end-user criteria, that you have small, medium, large, and then you just need to count employees or offices or whatever, and then you can decide, this is medium, this is small. And no arguing, no time wasted in haggling with the customers, and that's, especially for large-scale rollouts, you really, really don't want to do that.
From a customer point of view, the ISP might start charging you for every bit more you get in the address plan, which is also sort of an awkward business plan.
All right, well, that brings back to a point I was going to comment on, and then as the line got longer, I changed my mind and commented on something else. So two things. There have been a lot of assertions made in the community that ISPs like to charge for addresses and that it's a business model and so on. But my sense is that's actually a bit of a controversial assertion, in the sense that it certainly is the case that there are ISPs that will charge you for a quote-unquote higher quality of service that includes multiple addresses. But it gets iffy to say that is because that they are charging for the addresses. And you have to be careful about cause and effect. And, you know, what I want to see, I think one of the important things going back to what the motivations were with V6 is we don't want to get in a situation where ISPs can be perceived to be charging for addresses and having, you know, the LIRs or the RIRs back that up in terms of policy. I mean, maybe they end up still selling you, quote-unquote, you know, gold service that includes more addresses because they put you in a different class. But it shouldn't be because the RIRs have said that's what you have to do address conservation. And I think it's a very important distinction to make. I mean, people are always going to find, you know, marketing ways to justify trying to differentiate service and how they can charge and so forth. Okay, the other point I want to make, going back to the /64 boundary, my view is that there are clearly three places that we can push back on and get better utilization and be more conservative. The HD ratio, the /48 boundary, and the /64 boundary. But you have to sort of step back and ask, what's the low-hanging fruit? What's the easiest and the biggest bang for the buck? And probably the HD ratio is the easiest, because it doesn't seem to have any impact on end users and on most of the allocations. So that's sort of the easiest one to do. /48 to /56, that's also not horrible to do, but it does change some things, and you know, you have legacy allocations and so forth, but that's doable. But if you look at the /64, you know, it's easy to say, well, the IETF won't do it. The real problem with /64 is if you want to shift that out to /48 or something smaller, you have to rework the protocols. You have to rework implementations. You have to figure out how to transition from what's currently implemented and what's in the pipeline, and how you're going to transition to some other scheme. And, you know, my sort of, without having thought about it a whole lot, is that's a pretty hard problem, and it's not clear the bang for the buck is actually worth it at the end of the day. So, you know, the thing to do in any case is go for all three sort of independently and see where you end up. But don't try to gate one on the other and say 64 is really where we ought to be focusing, because there's so many more bits.
Thank you.
Leah Roberts again. I wanted to also address Bernard's question. I think the whole concept of doing variable allocations in V6, we wanted to get away from the concept of address scarcity here. There should, you should have plenty more addresses than you need. And so creating some categories inside the slash 48 just is to try and get away from a little bit of overreaction in that direction.
Okay. So I haven't asked Bernard's question actually to the audience. You still want me to ask that question or not? Okay. So correct me if I'm wrong. Do people think we should really go for just one category with flexible allocations beyond that one category? Right formulation?
Well, what you're asking, I think what you're really getting at is an or question. So why don't you say, here's the two questions I'm going to ask, and pick one of them that you want to.
I'm not sure whether that's fair to Bernard in the sense that we also know that, you know, when you formulate a referendum or something like that, if you ask it to, if you ask for a no, then you get a different answer than if you ask for a yes. but I think actually the opinion probably in this room is enough
if you ask one
to
question,
one
if you ask one question first and the other opposite question afterwards, you can actually have people answering yes to both, and then you will get a different view.
Perfect. So the first question is going to be, would people like to have one category and beyond that flexible allocation sizes? And the second question is going to be, do people want more categories, more buckets to put the allocations in? So, and that could be two, three, more, whatever. I don't want to fix that yet. Yes.
48, 64, and slash 128, even though we really only been talking about 64 and 48.
Yeah.
So, you know, in some sense, I think what you're getting at is should we only have like one bucket or, you know, more than those three categories that we already have. Yeah.
So let's start with the first question, one bucket. Okay, that's three people. more buckets. A lot. Okay. I think, considering the time, etc., we are getting at the end of this discussion. I think we have basically had a good discussion. I think there's we have enough input now for the authors of this potential draft to get a good start. I hope this topic will be brought up in other fora too, like APNIC meetings, ARIN meetings, etc. Let's go from there. I bet this topic is going to come back with a more detailed proposal that we actually can read next time. Because, as you have noticed, this is the IPv6 working group. Normally, we discuss technical boundaries here. Because of the lack of time that we had in the local IR working group, we decided to move this topic to the IPv6 working group. We might find next time that we will discuss this in the policy working group. You will find out next time, because this is really, you know, a boundary area. Thank you. We have one final topic. That is Carlos with a brief presentation on IPv6 work at the Portuguese NRANs and a quick slide on the European IPv6 task forces. And after that, we're done. Carlos.
The other one is also fast. Okay. I work as an internet engineer for FCCN, which is the Portuguese NRAN. In the last year, we have been writing a lot of documents in Portuguese about IPv6 and doing some enabling of services and a lot of that stuff. We have some specific projects One of the biggest one is a self-owned fiber path between Lisbon and Braga, which is up on the north. And for that equipment tender, one aspect is one important aspect was that IPv6 was mandated. So the candidates that didn't support IPv6 were rejected. About the school initiative, we have about 9,000 schools. The ISDN to ADSL migration has already started. It's currently over the 2,000 mark. We are working with Portugal Telecom, which is the DSL provider, and they have presented a fair good solution. And we are using a billion CPEs on the schools. So about 2,000 of them are already deployed, still only running V4, but we already have the software image to enable V6. The EU Virtual Campuses Initiative is about wireless campuses in universities. So this is some data, and the focus is mainly on the roaming capability, and this initiative is also linked with the EduRoam initiative at the European level. So these are the lesson learned. Any questions? So then I, okay. And then the next presentation is about European IPv6 task forces. Well, the current status is that we only have 14, and only 12 of them have seeable web pages through the IPv6taskforce.org website, which it seems to me that it's a low number if we consider the number of countries in Europe. So this is the current status. Mostly of the task force are doing nothing. One thing that was identified is that more people from industry is needed on each task force to help push the effort for IPv6. So this is our request. We need people to reinforce the existing national task forces, or in the countries that they don't exist, we need to find people to help build new national task forces. So this is the address. So David is also a part of the steering committee of the European IPv6 task force. So he is also able to answer questions.
Okay. Any questions? No. We are nearly at the end. Where are the attendance sheets? After I get them back, we are done. Okay, the attendance sheets have been located, so I guess we are done. Thank you for being here at this early hour after this nice dinner yesterday, and see you again next meeting in Amsterdam. Oops.